Welcome to the Parliamentary Podcast Series, Partnering for Global Impact, presented by the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Parliamentary Engagement Teams of the World Bank and IMF. Join us as we engage in discussions with leading development experts and parliamentarians from around the world. Together, we'll explore how we can take decisive action to achieve a world free of poverty on a livable planet. Now, please welcome your host, Liam Byrne, Chairman of the Parliamentary Network.
Here from the IMF, please welcome Rex Ghosh from the International Monetary Fund.
Great. Great,
Rex, it's a great privilege to have you with us. You're the historian, the in-house historian of the IMF and in the strategy team here. We've got about 45 minutes, so what I thought would be really useful to do is if you wouldn't mind kicking off just with a very quick reminder of why we created the IMF. And just a word or two on how we fund it. And then we will open it up to questions. I know that we didn't get everybody in the last session, so I've got Ghana, but anybody else who wants to come in, please just signal during the course of Rex's remarks. But Rex, there's so much misunderstanding about what the IMF is for and what it does. Why did we build it in the first place?
Thank you. First of all, you mentioned it's a privilege. It is my privilege to be here with such an august body of parliamentarians. And thank you for arranging this. So last year was the 80th anniversary of the Bretton Woods Conference, which established the IMF and the World Bank. And that is often hailed as a great triumph of multilateralism and international cooperation, and it certainly was that. But just to give a little bit of history, it didn't start out that way. In fact, the origins of the Bretton Woods Conference was, in fact, the US trade interests. So at the time, the British Empire, its dominions, its colonies, had something called the imperial preferences. Which was basically a free trade area, including Canada, for that sterling area, and quite stiff trade barriers with the rest of the world, including the US. So the US was very determined to break these trade barriers. So as part of, Lend-Lease was a program during the war where, because of Britain could no longer afford to buy war materials, Roosevelt arranged this Lend-Lease where they lent war materials. And as part of that agreement, there was one of the articles stated that there would be agreed action by the US and the United Kingdom, open to participation with any other country that was willing to participate, to the elimination of all forms of discriminatory treatment in international commerce and to the reduction of tariffs. Okay. So that was the origin of the conference. And in approaching that conference, every country, argued for its own self-interests, quite rightly. But something very interesting happened, and it was summarized by the Treasury Secretary Morgenthau at the time in his closing speech for the conference. He says, "None of us has found any incompatibility between devotion to our own country and joint action. On the contrary, the only genuine safeguard to our national interests lies in international cooperation. We have come to recognize that the wisest and most effective way to protect our national interests is through international cooperation, that is to say, through united effort for the attainment of common goals." And that was really the triumph of the Bretton Woods system, and it's the basis on which the IMF was created. And Article 1 of the Articles of Agreement of the IMF is to be a permanent institution to foster international cooperation. Now, more precisely, the IMF has three basic functions. One is surveillance. Surveillance has two parts to it. One is the kind of health check of the economy to help prevent crises and in general to foster orderly growth and reasonable price stability. Another part of surveillance is on the spillovers, the contagion, the positive and negative spillovers between countries. The second function is lending. And the third function is capacity building, technical assistance. So those are the sort of purposes of the IMF. But it's really about fostering international cooperation.
And in the very early days after Bretton Woods, 1944, it was quite a slow start for the IMF, wasn't it? It wasn't really until we got into more accelerated trade liberalisation that the IMF really began to become important.
Yes. Actually, during World War II, many of the then developing countries had actually accumulated quite a lot of foreign reserves because they had been supplying commodities during the war. And it was mainly Europe that was going to be the big borrowers. However, we had the Marshall Plan. And so the understanding with the IMF was that if you were a Marshall Plan recipient, you would not tap IMF resources. And so the IMF starts its lending activities in a sort of more major way, starting in the 1960s, sometimes commodity exporters facing commodity price shocks, you know, would turn to the IMF for balance of payments financing. And then in the 70s, we have the oil price shocks. Of course, countries have to adjust to that, finance big oil import bills. 1980s, the debt crisis. 1990s, the transition economies, plus some major capital account crises in emerging markets. Go into the 2000s, we have the global financial crisis, 2008, and then more recently, the pandemic, the 2020 pandemic.
So I'll open the floor to questions in a second, but I just would love your one take on this, which is, when you trace the history of the IMF, you can see that much of its evolution has been crisis-driven. It's had to change and adapt and step up in response to crises. What do you think are the lessons from the past that might be especially useful for policymakers this week? Based on the way the IMF has successfully adapted over the years, what are some of the things that you think policymakers could learn from the history of the fund?
Well, that's an excellent question. I wish I knew the answer, but let me try one.
We'll tape this and we'll send it round before they get here tomorrow.
I think not to react kind of impulsively and immediately, but rather take the time to analyze, and that's a lot of our work, for example, the World Economic Outlook, the GFSR, and so on, provide analysis, and then on that build the sort of policy reactions. Obviously, in good times, build up buffers. Now, the problem has been that, let me just backtrack a moment. If you look at the World Economic Outlook and IMF papers from the early 2000s, they would often say you have aging populations in many countries. Now is the time to build up resilience to that by paying down debt, or at least bringing down the debt to GDP ratio. Right? Then we get hit by the global financial crisis, and obviously, debt goes up. We come out of that sort of mid to 2015-ish, and for the low-income countries, they get hit by the commodity price decline 2015. And then on top of that, we have the pandemic. Again, debt goes up. So it's very difficult. Countries cannot catch their breath. right? So it's kind of easy for us to say, well, build up resilience, build up buffers. When are you going to do that? I think the only answer can be that we have to be mindful of the fact that we're in a more shock-prone world. And so we have to try and build up buffers whenever we can, whenever we get some kind of positive windfall, build up the buffers. And second, put in place, you know, medium-term fiscal consolidation. For example, you know, if your state pension system is going to run into deficits, start doing the adjustment now. Can be relatively small adjustment, timely adjustment, you know, pays big dividends down the road. I did want to come back to your question about the financing of the IMF itself.
Yeah.
You know, we have publications that explain our financing. It sounds incredibly complicated. It's in fact extremely simple. The IMF is essentially a credit union for countries rather than for individuals. So when all members of the IMF are members of this credit union, if we're using your money to make loans, in other words, you're in a creditor position, you receive interest on that. If you're borrowing, you pay interest. The difference between the remuneration rate and the lending rate for non-concessional borrowers is about a half percentage point per year, and that pays for all the administrative costs associated with lending. And of course, lower income countries get concessional financing, which is essentially a zero interest rate at the moment. All the other activities are financed by interest on our endowment. So we created an endowment in 2009-ish. And so we do not rely on annual contributions from taxpayers at all. So that's IMF financing in a nutshell.
But it's an important point because it's not a net cost to taxpayers.
Correct.
For example.
Yeah.
So they will put money in, but actually they will earn
interest on that.
Exactly. So I wouldn't mind just coming to the question that was posed from France this morning about imbalances, if that's okay, because it would be useful to get your take on that. Sorry to cold call, but would you mind just putting that question on imbalances again? I thought that was just a very useful discussion point this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for the honor. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. My question this morning was about global imbalances, the need to acknowledge the existence of these imbalances, which are a threat for both the economic and the political dimensions of globalization, and how do we address them without resorting to trade wars that we know are both absurd and destructive. So obviously there are things that can be done at the domestic level to rebalance. Europe needs to invest more, China needs more consumption, the US needs more consolidation. But do we need some kind of international agreement to help this rebalancing the way we had in the past? We had it around the Plaza and Le Louvre agreements in the 80s. We had some kind of fiscal policy coordination after the global financial crisis of 2008. And what kind of instruments could be used? Could it be exchange rate coordination? Should it be a fiscal policies coordination? Should it be more regulation of capital flows? Whatever. So that was my question this morning, so I'm glad to ask.
Perfect.
It again.
Great. Thank you. I can't see your country, but you're waving your hand at me.
Yeah.
So it's over to you.
Merci beaucoup. Je suis la France aussi.
Thank you very much. I'm French also, but it's not the same question. French also, but not the same question. A question, if I may, on the topic of tariff barriers, because we already talked about this morning when Madame Georgieva was here. We'll wait until you can hear my question. So I wanted to ask a question on the tariff barriers, because we broached the topic this morning with Kristalina this morning. So my question is the following. My topic is to see why are we talking about this now in the economic debate in the world, because it is brought by governments, and the social base and electoral base considers, whether it's right or not, that they are the losers in the financial and economic system in the world and the globalization. So I see that you're, you know, the UK is saying yes. I have two questions, thus. As a historian, as you may be, did we already have, since the IMF exists, a situation that would be the same where you have the countries that created the IMF, where you have political bases that are considered themselves that they are losers because of your policies? And second question, from today's time and this feeling that is progressing in North America and in Europe, the IMF will, and the monetary and economic system as it is in the world right now, is it in danger or not?
Great question. And then let's go to Cameroon and then Canada.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair of the Parliamentary Network, I want to thank you for this discussion with the IMF. I just want to show a bit of concern. Let you explain to us, Mr. Goshi. When the IMF give money to a country as borrow, you don't have policies that you can follow up the implementation of this loan that you borrowed this nation. If they misuse this money, does your interest is only to get back your money or to follow up to make sure that that money was given for the good of the people of Africa? Because it is a very difficult issue. Sometimes you borrow money for a particular purpose, for the good of the people, but the money is misdirected. And the IMF is only interested in the money to be paid back. And this money is paid by the taxpayers. That is the people. We as parliamentarians, what can we do to help such a situation? What policy can you put in place to capacitate the MPs in following up the money that you borrow to the African people to be able to help the people for sustainable living? Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And let's go to Canada now.
Yes, hello. So my name is Rosa Galvez from the Senate of Canada. Thank you, Mr. Ghosh, for reminding us the history of IMF and its mission. So one of the three goals and mission you mentioned is to survey the stability and to prevent shocks. So Georgelina told us this morning that, we are suffering shock after shock after shock, and the ones that have more resilience to this virus shock will survive, and others probably not. So if the IMF had as a goal to prevent and to see what are the threats to the stability of the economy, what are the obstacles that IMF has and that didn't see the 2008 crisis coming, or didn't see these tariff wars that is coming, and the new shocks that are seems to be in line? It has to do with not enough independence of the IMF to carry with efficiency this goal of preventing shocks. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Very good question. Lithuania.
Thank you. Katerina Reka from Lithuania. It's connected with your remark about the debt and fiscal sustainability all over. Well, the global defense expenditure soared to a new height just recently, and it's programmed to grow further And even Lithuania is also expecting to spend much more, about 5 to 6% of GDP on that. But it's coupled with the higher fiscal pressure. And of course, adding to the already existing government debt in most of the countries. So do you expect that overall tax will rise globally? And it's very great to hear that IMF doesn't rely on the taxes from people, but unfortunately, well, all the expenditures do. And to what extent it will impact the economic stability? Thank you.
Great. And then let me just take Uganda as well as the final question in that round.
Yeah, I think it's Uganda. From the submission of the history of the creation of IMF, I've now realized the primary mandate, apart from expecting interest from the recipients, you also focus the resources on crisis. Just like we would applaud you for the much resources that are being focused on the crisis in Ukraine. The question is, does it mean that the resources are focused in any given crisis on those that have far-reaching repercussions on global markets and trade? And crises or conflicts in countries like South Sudan or Democratic Republic of Congo that are less economically impactful are given less attention?
Great question, thank you. And then I saw Kenya and then Cameroon.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask whether what we are seeing globally is chaos by design, whereby we have, for example, the US is a major stakeholder in World Bank IMF. And now they are creating a crisis globally and you are trying to resolve it. So they're on this other side and on this other side. What has been the advice for IMF and World Bank to the US government?
That's a great question. Thank you. And then finally, Cameroon.
Yeah, the history of the IMF as presented by Mr. Ghosh is that of bailing countries during period of global economic crisis. Presently, the trade war between US and China is pushing the world again to an abyss of another global economic crisis. In fact, Jeffrey Sachs, I think that is how they pronounce the name, has already painted a very global picture, warning that it has sparked off a situation where the world is losing about $10 trillion, dollars in terms of trade worldwide. So I just want to ask the IMF, as we have from the history, what are they doing? Because they have already seen or they are already projecting what is going to happen. So what are they doing to brace themselves to be able to tackle, any economic crisis, before it actually drains down the entire global situation or the entire world? So my problem is they have already seen it. What are they doing? What steps are they putting in place to be able to handle any pending crisis that may result, or wait for it to happen before we start taking action? In other words, how proactive are they to handle such situation? Is this what is happening now? Thank you.
Great. Well, there's a wide range of questions there. Some really interesting patterns as well, I think, about crisis surveillance and crisis anticipation. But take it where you will.
Thank you for these questions. I'm not sure I have answers to all of them, or maybe even any of them. First of all, je m'excuse, je vais répondre en anglais.
I'm sorry, I will answer in English.
On the imbalances,
So part of why the IMF was created, I didn't get into this, was to help in the international adjustment process. And in fact, leading up to the Great Depression, actually the US and France kind of vitiated the international adjustment process by sterilizing the reserve inflows, the gold inflows. And so part of why the IMF was created was to facilitate the international adjustment process. So there's nothing wrong with an imbalance per se. It's very natural that countries have surpluses and deficits vis-a-vis each other at different periods of time. Normally, we would expect developing countries, capital scarce countries to have a current account deficit as they are growing and drawing in investment. But the imbalances can become dangerously large. And we saw that, in 2005, 2006, before the global financial crisis, the IMF then had its multilateral consultation to help reduce those imbalances. In the event the global financial crisis kind of overtook events. But that was the kind of reason the IMF exists, in part in order to reduce these imbalances when they become dangerously large. Now, there may be also specific sectors that countries, for national security reasons or whatever, may want to protect, but that's a slightly different use of trade instruments. If you want to reduce your overall current account deficit, there's only two ways to do it. You raise domestic savings or you reduce domestic investment. This is just a mathematical, you know, identity. And so there, the kind of policy advice typically centers around fiscal policy, to raise savings through raising public savings, reducing the fiscal deficit. And then also raising the efficiency of investment so that, you're not just investing in unproductive investments. So I jotted down some of the questions. Let me just, in the interest of time, kind of go forward on that. Will taxes rise globally? I think they're going to have to. In many countries, they're facing elevated debt levels, right? And they still have spending priorities. And so that probably means that not in every country, obviously, but probably on average, tax levels are going to have to rise. In many countries, the tax ratio is very low. So it may not necessarily imply steeply rising tax rates, but broadening the tax base so that, you know, we don't have economic efficiency losses. And part of the debt sustainability, or making debts more sustainable, is this three-pillar approach, one of which is domestic resource mobilization. The other two pillars are more support from bilateral, multilateral creditors, and also more sort of better financing from the private sector. That's the third pillar of the three-pillar approach. There was a question about kind of governance around IMF lending. So the IMF does not lend for specific projects. It supports the authority's economic program. And the letter of intent is always published. So there's kind of full accountability of that. We also have what's called safeguard assessments of the central bank to make sure that the funds are not diverted or misused. But we do not finance specific projects. Okay. It's financing of the budget deficit, well, of the balance of payments and therefore the budget deficit in general. And it's in support of the authority's program, and the letter of intent is always published. In addition, we do, as part of our surveillance, we have an enhanced framework for promoting good governance, anti-money laundering, but also more broadly, sort of good economic governance. Why did we miss the global financial crisis? That's a very good question. Personally, I see the global financial crisis as being, you know, deep-rooted in the shifts in the global economy, coupled with a failure of financial regulation, particularly in the US. What I think we missed was the repercussions of that financial crisis. So we did not see, and I don't think many people saw, how the subprime mortgage, which was like 6% of the US mortgage market, which is huge, how that would kind of bring down the US financial system, and then through the collapse of the wholesale funding market, get transmitted to Europe, and then kind of globally, how the crisis spread. So I don't think it was a matter of a lack of independence. We just didn't see the analytics that clearly ahead of time. On the current situation, no, we did not foresee this. However, for well, almost a decade now, we have been putting greater emphasis on what is the income distribution impact of globalization, so on. Personally, I think it's less a matter of trade than of technology. If you go to any supermarket in the US and in many other countries, they have replaced the checkout clerk with a machine. Right? You do self-checkout. So that's not trade. Those jobs have been lost not because of trade, but because of technology. And most of the shifts that are happening are because of technological progress that, you know, obviously makes some jobs redundant. But this is something that, you know, all countries are having to deal with. I think economists' usual response is a bit facile to say, well, you retrain. That's not really very realistic for many people. I mean, it would be like telling me, oh, why don't you retrain to be a coal miner or a construction worker? It's not going to happen, right? But I think the real key is making sure that young people aren't going into dying industries. So there's an existing stock of, you know, 50-year-old workers. You know, societies can deal with their transition, you know, out of those jobs. The real problem is if an 18-year-old gets into a dying industry, you know, what are you going to do 10 years down the road? So on what the IMF is doing about the current situation, well, in some sense, that's what these spring meetings are all about. Mm. And obviously, we're going to hear from the whole membership, and the US is going to hear from the whole membership. And this is really part of the essence of the IMF, is that it promotes a dialogue between countries. And so they can hear from each other and try to find solutions that leave everyone better off.
Perfect. So we're almost out of time, but let me just, yeah, South Sudan, you were trying to get in earlier, so come in on this one. And Zambia, yeah, okay.
Well, thank you so much once again. This is Reyes Tan from South Sudan, a member of parliament. I would like to thank the World Bank and the IMF because as part of the Energy Committee in the Parliament, I know the funding that you give for energy sector, that the grid transmission extension and also capacity building for the Minister of Energy. And also, we thanks also the IMF also for extending also some support to the government of South Sudan. My question are, given that some of the government turn to their own citizen, and there are evidence of the government links violence, what safeguard do you have to ensure funding doesn't empower human rights violation? Number two, can the IMF and the World Bank support directly the local displaced people? Like, in, for example, in South Sudan, we have like 208,113 people locally displaced. We have two places in Juba, one in the airport and one in near the Unimis. One each of 7,679 people, and the other camp had 25,000 people. In Upper Nile State, we have two sites, 2,970 people, and site two with 35,000 people. In Unity State, we have 137,430 people. These are people who are locally displaced, and because when the war happened in 2013, they ran to the, and we thank the United Nations, because if they did not go to UNMIS camp, we would have the same scenario of Rwanda. Now, my question is, can you deal with these people directly and support them? Because they don't have education, they don't have health service. Since you are helping our country, can you also see a special program for these people?
Thank you. So much. Very acute situation, Sambia.
Okay, thank you so very much. My name is Siveso. I'm a member of parliament from Zambia. And thank you so very much, Mr. President, for the interactions that we've had with World Bank and IMF today. I wanted to find out from Mr. Ghosh, one of the things that you've said in regards to IMF is that they also do capacity building. Zambia is one of those countries that have benefited from the extended credit facility, and also we've managed to have our debt restructured. But in regards to capacity building, so that the countries, for example, the African countries can have their own local grown solution in regards to absorbing the shock. Do you have any countries that you've worked with, for example, just in the recent, that have been able to be able to absorb the shocks better, or not to come back to IMF and borrow again? Because what has happened repeatedly is that after the help, countries still come back again after and after. So do we have any examples that we can give of countries that have been able to do that?
It's a great question, because I think many of us will have questions and interests in case studies where countries have been able to escape the sort of cycle that you describe. Welcome any replies to that. I suppose that the last kind of wrap-up question for me is, as the old saying goes, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it does rhyme. And so as you kind of look at the situation we face today, I'll be just very interested in where are the kind of historical moments in the IMF's history that perhaps might furnish us the best lessons.
Right. So first, from the South Sudan question, so I think your question is more directed or more relevant to the World Bank, which works on specific projects. The IMF deals with the government, the authorities, and is, as I mentioned, is in support of their economic program. So it's essentially budget financing. So it's not specific to one project or one group or another.
on whether countries ever graduate from the IMF. United Kingdom. It was one of the earliest and largest borrowers. But more recently, countries like Brazil had numerous programs, and then since 2003 has not had an IMF-supported program, hasn't needed one. India had its last program with the IMF in 1991. That doesn't mean that, there may not be a shock that comes and the IMF is there to support its members. And a number of countries have moved from financing, low-income countries move from financing programs to non-financing programs, so it's essentially enhanced surveillance. And we created the policy support instrument or policy coordination instrument precisely to provide sort of economic advice and monitoring for other investors and other donors to have confidence in the policies, but not requiring IMF money. And in fact, that is the kind of ideal situation, is that all countries, all member countries move to that, so that IMF financing is the exception, not the norm. But that doesn't mean that, again, if there is a big shock, that's why we're here, to help countries. On your question, I'm glad we're running out of time because it's going to be a... we've had major shocks, world economy shocks, the oil price shocks, the debt crisis, the global financial crisis, COVID, and we've come through those. I think it's fair to say the IMF and the bank helped countries deal with these, and that's what we're going to do, in the current situation. This is an unusual shock. There was, of course, the Nixon tariffs, 10% surcharge, went on in August 71. That was actually to bring mostly the group of 10 countries to the negotiating table to revalue their currencies. As soon as the Smithsonian Agreement happened in December of 71, they lifted those surcharges. So hopefully something like that.
Fingers crossed. Ms. Gosh, thank you so much. That has been extremely interesting and extremely useful, and it's of immense benefit to the Parliamentary Network members to know a bit more about the history of the institutions that we're seeking to work with. Please join me in saying a huge thank you to Mr. Gosh from the IMF.
Thank you very much.